Let's hope not.
Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, New York Times blogger Paul Krugman makes a comment on 9/11 from the cheap seats. Pigpile on Perry, the Tea Party has their debate in Tampa. Who are the winners? Who are not the winners? Read losers. Special elections are being held in the New York 9th Congressional District and Nevada 2nd District. Is this a telltale sign of things to come in 2012? This, Tell Me a Story and More, today, live on Backroom Politics. Here in the nation's capital, beautiful day here in Washington, D.C. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. Joining me as they are every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd congressional district.
I'm so glad you got through that.
I was predicated on something else.
I see.
East Congressman Al Swift. Hi, Al.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Joining me across the table as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Always glad to be here.
To my right, as he is every Tuesday, or as much as he can be, he is the former service of 4 presidents. He has served in the committee on the Senate. He is a well-established, well-known pundit inside the Beltway. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
And we've got a lot to get to. Obviously, busy week. Getting back into session, a lot of things happening, but we're going to start off today with something that really struck me that happened during the 9/11 commemorations on Sunday. First of all, I don't know if anybody has seen the 9/11 memorial up in New York. It is absolutely gorgeous. I think it is an absolutely fitting tribute and is about as well done as could be expected for something that just embraces the whole nation. But I got to tell you something. The one thing that disturbed me out of all the commemorations, out of all of the honors given to those who made the ultimate sacrifice on that day 10 years ago, Paul Krugman, a blogger for the New York Times and a former candidate to head up the Economic Council inside the White House for Obama, came out with the following blog, and I want to read this to everybody so everybody knows what we're talking about. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation here on the show, you can call up 619-638-8477. Again, at 619-638-8477, we will get you on the air with our roundtable to talk about anything inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, anything political. Let's go back to this blog from Paul Krugman. I want to read this, and I hope that everybody understands why I am absolutely incensed about this. This was September 11th. It was posted by Mr. Krugman at 8:41 a.m. The title of the blog is The Years of Shame, and I read, "Is it just me, or are the 9/11 commemorations oddly subdued? Actually, I don't think it's me. And it's not really that odd. What happened after 9/11, and I think even people on the right know this, whether they admit it or not, was deeply shameful. The atrocity should have been a unifying event, but instead it became a wedge issue. Fake heroes like Bernie Kerik, Rudy Giuliani, and yes, George W. Bush raced to cash in on the horror. and then the attack was used to justify an unrelated war the neocons wanted to fight for all the wrong reasons. A lot of other people behaved badly. How many of our professional pundits, people who should have understood very well what was happening, took the easy way out, turning a blind eye to the corruption and lending their support to the hijacking of the atrocity? The memory of 9/11 has been irrevocably poisoned. It has become an occasion for shame, and in its heart, the nation knows it. And he closes out by saying, I am not going to allow comments on this post for obvious reasons. When I read this, I was absolutely livid that one of the last bastions of true journalism, the New York Times, would allow a blog like that to go out on September 11th, literally minutes before 10 years ago, a plane slammed into the first tower at World Trade Center. My thought on this is Paul Krugman doesn't have skin in this game. What has Paul Krugman done that, I mean, these are literally comments from the cheap seats. Alan.
Yeah, I think there should be a law against the Nobel Prize Committee giving the Nobel Prize to younger guys. Paul Krugman won the Nobel Prize. He, as a macroeconomist, the big piece, the big think of economics, he has used that platform, that credibility of a Nobel Prize, to spout off on any number of subjects about which he knows nothing, and people say, yeah, but he won the Nobel Prize. He is so off base on this, so wrong, and so missed what I thought was an extraordinary weekend of reminiscences, not just of the memorials, the reflection, the extensive pieces that all of the networks did, the newspapers did, those of us who lived through that day. Well, we all remember where we were that day. I happened to have been in the U.S. Capitol, so it came home in a big way to me, but it came home in a very big way to everyone. Did all the decisions that followed 9/11 make the most sense in the eye of the rearview mirror? No, but I think he is just way off base, and it's really interesting that they didn't allow any responses, because they would have been nasty and ugly.
Oh, absolutely, Bob.
I couldn't agree more with Alan. And I might make one other point. Krugman has been off base on all kinds of issues that he doesn't know very much about for years. Alan is exactly right. You give somebody an award when he's too young and, you know, look what happens. He's a perfect example. I mean, he may be a fine economist, but he doesn't know squat about most of the things he writes about.
But, Al, you have to be smart to win a Nobel Peace Prize. I can't imagine.
Not a Peace Prize.
Or Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize
in
economics.
Prize. You have to be smart to win a Nobel Prize of any kind, whether it's a Nobel Peace Prize, whether it's a Nobel Prize for economics. You have to have some brains. What part of his brain failed when he decided that he would write this?
Don't equate intelligence with wisdom. It's usually helpful to have both. But there are some people who are undereducated and maybe not the brightest bulbs in the box who sometimes make some very wise observations about the world. And there are educated idiots who never become wise. I find one thing in there that I would defend. I will not defend him saying that George Bush and that Rudy Giuliani were fake heroes on the day. I think without Rudy Giuliani calming the city for several days, there could have been a lot more bad things occur. But the fact that the administration, I believe, did use it subsequently, not on that day, not on that week, not in that month, but subsequently, as an excuse to do something that I absolutely believe they wanted to do all along, that I think is true, and I have always found that very objectionable.
Do you think making that comment on 9/11, the morning of the 10th anniversary, was it appropriate in this case?
Oh, if you're going to have blogs you can't expect them all to be appropriate. I wouldn't have done it that way.
Bob?
It's a free country. He can say what he wants to say. I just wish that he would have been inundated by irate American citizens who were saying to themselves, how could someone who has the honors and the intelligence and the opportunities he had, how could he be so wrong about the American public and about the way we feel about that day and the people who responded so heroically to try to take care of the people who were in danger?
Well, and the one thing you didn't say about him when you trashed him was he's also a coward to say something like that and then say, I will not take any comments on it.
For obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons, is just cowardly.
It is. It is. Alan.
Yeah, my only thought is, if you're going to say, I agree with my pals here, but I think that in terms of the timing, he should have written it a couple of days ahead of time, not on the day, and then let people respond and come back at him and give the Times, even though it was just a blog. This is a guy with high visibility who has a couple of columns a week
in the New York Times
in the New York Times, and he has the blog as well. So it's all the same guy. Come out there early with it, not just drop it down there like a little bomb,
right?
The expression on 9/11
to say I won't talk about it anymore.
I've said it. It's out there. Don't talk to me about it because I'm not going to take any comments. I think also the one question I have for Paul Krugman is, where were you on 9/11? Unless you can prove to me that you made sacrifices like so many, who even the first responders who didn't lose their life but are still feeling the after effects of that, the people who had to go in there and see their brethren being pulled out of the rubble. You know, I remember the picture of the fire department's chaplain, Father Judge, being pulled out. I saw that on Saturday night, and it still brought me to tears. I think this blog post is it dishonors and it just vilifies the first responders and the people that made the ultimate sacrifice, including the civilians on Flight 93. I think it's an atrocity. He should be censured.
I want to say one last thing. We're sort of censoring him. We're in a way giving him more credit than I think he deserves, and giving him more visibility. I think that you know, here's a guy who oftentimes speaks outside of his level of expertise. As Al said, he may be brilliant, but he's not particularly wise. I say, let's remember this and pay less attention to him, including
Paul,
today.
Paul who?
Paul,
right.
Paul, exactly. Yeah. But what bugs me is, this is obviously an individual who has the ear of the White House when it comes to economic and socioeconomic issues. How the White House did not come out and condemn that statement is beyond me. You're kind of wincing a little bit, Al.
Well, I'm wincing a little bit because, you know, if a president or anybody has to take the moral responsibility for things that any of their friends and associates say, you know, I think that's going too far.
I'll say one thing. I'll make you a bet that the president today is very pleased that he didn't decide to appoint Coover to be his chief economic advisor.
Oh, I think a lot of people in the White House are going, this is a really brilliant move not to appoint him.
Because they'd have to ask him to resign, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and it's hard to know how close that ever came, because this guy has spouted off and said a lot of things that the White House wouldn't want to have to defend. It didn't start here. You stepped into an interesting subject, though. When should the White House or the president disassociate itself from something? This guy wrote a blog. He writes for the New York Times. He's got no association. He has no power to speak for the White House. I think the White House should keep mum on that. If the president were ever asked at a press conference, what did he think, he can say at that time, but I wouldn't initiate it. I think that was the right response. Something else happened recently, though, and that is that the president of the Teamsters Union, James Hoffa, introduced the president at a speech, and in the introduction made a reference to Tea Partiers as sons of bitches, and said, let's take them out, and then here's the president. Now, this is the president who, after Gabby Giffords was shot in Arizona, made some passionate, moving, correct comments about the state of civil discourse in this country. Not people took offense. Gee, are you saying, as Sarah Palin did, that there's blood on my hands because Gabby Giffords got shot? I had nothing to do with that. Don't lay that on me. Well, here was some very ugly rhetoric in the introduction to President Obama speaking, which is a very different matter. Jimmy Hoffa doesn't work for the White House, but it would have been a lovely opportunity for this president to say, oh, I know we all can get carried away sometimes, but I hope we can remember the need for civil discourse towards those with whom we disagree.
Well, the argument comes out, and you know, I'm not going to defend or vilify Mr. Hoffa. It's well known. I'm a staunch advocate for the Teamsters Union. I think they do a lot of good things. I think Mr. Hoffa is a good guy. He's about as patriotic an American as there is. But it brings up the argument, though, Alan, is what he said. I mean, we've been using rhetoric in politics for years, hundreds of years, even back to the days of Stonewall Jackson and back to the days of Tippecanoe and Tyler too, where they were bringing up war cries and, you know, remember the Maine, et cetera. We've been doing that a lot. We've had, targets. Now, Sarah Palin got taken out for putting targets on districts, crosshairs targets. She was vilified for that. At what point do we start being rhetoric police and start looking at the reality?
Exactly. At what point? And Bob will remember this. When the world fell in on Senator from Mississippi, your friend
Trent Lott,
because he made an unfortunate allusion
to racism.
It was in one of those situations, and any of us been in politics have been there, where you're throwing raw meat to the audience, and sometimes you just go on automatic pilot, and you say things that get the big hoorahs, and you don't mean it, and they're not thoughtful.
That was at a birthday party for Strom Thurmond.
Yeah. Right.
I said at the time that I thought that it was.
We're over distracted by the owner, Bob, who's just walked into the smoke encrusted studio of Backroom Politics.
We wanted to be sure he wasn't going to take our drinks away.
Bob, thanks for joining us.
He's taking my drink away.
He's taking his drink away already. That's bad.
But the point is, I thought that it was an unfortunate remark. I'm sure that Trent, the moment he let out, he wished he could have retracted it, but I thought the reaction to it was way overboard. And here you got a Teamster, and labor guys talk certain ways, and they build up audiences in certain ways, and I think that it was inappropriate, but
here's the funny thing about it is, I think it was, because it was Mr. Hoffa and the Teamsters, and let's be honest, there's a certain stigma that's associated with Teamsters being crowbar heavy, being a bunch of muscle. If Trumka from the AFL-CIO, the president of the AFL-CIO, had said that, do you think that the rhetoric or the flashback on that would have been as bad? If it had been somebody other than Mr. Hoffa?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look at the words. Referring to the Tea Party, let's take out the sons of bitches. That was what was said in the introduction to the president. I don't care if those guys talk that way at union meetings or in other crowds. This was a different setting.
That's an important point. But on the other hand, where was all this reaction to it?
There was reaction. It only lasted 24 hours because there was other issues that topped it. Bob, you have a comment on this.
I think it's important to note that I have heard two versions of the introduction of Mr. Hoffa.
Right.
Of the president.
Right.
Yes. One of them was on several of the cable news versions, and it sounded exactly the way Alan
said it.
Reported.
Right.
There's a longer version of it, which was what he actually said, which doesn't sound nearly as inflammatory.
Agreed.
And it was edited.
Agreed.
It was edited in a way that I don't know whether it was edited before it just because they decided to edit it and make it hotter, or whether they just made him, they just left out a lot of alliteration.
We're back to our friends in the press.
It's an interesting thing. I've heard both versions.
You know, I read the longer version too.
Right.
But I believe that particular choice of words, and you know, we can read the whole speech, and people can draw a conclusion. I just don't think. I don't think when you're introducing the President of the United States before any crowd that you're going to refer to your opponents as sons of bitches, and I don't think you're going to use the phrase take them out.
Yeah.
Whether it's in a long context, short context, yeah. If that is your meaning.
Right.
He's not saying, let's get some takeout for dinner tonight. This was take them out, and it was referring to them that way. And context and situation makes a difference. Of course these guys talk that way. So do all of us.
We're
not introducing the president.
The one thing we can agree on is it certainly wasn't civil, and it wasn't helpful. It wasn't uplifting to the debate that's going on in this country.
No, I would say that's not the case. But I would also say that as long as we're going to use political rhetoric, at what point
it was inappropriate.
It may have been inappropriate. If he had done that at the Teamsters convention, perhaps. When introducing the president, I think he may have gotten carried away. I mean, let's be, you know, again, not to defend or to vilify Mr. Hoffa, he's introducing the president in front of union members, not just Teamsters, in Detroit, Michigan, which has historically high unemployment rates, and they're having to fight state legislatures that are trying to do away with collective bargaining and the cutting down of government unions and cutting down of government employees. I think that, did he get a little carried away? Perhaps. I don't think that it is the intention of Mr. Hoffa that he actually, you know, support the idea that Teamsters should go out and take out Tea Party members. There's not a violent bone in that man's body.
Take out is a term that is used in politics all the time for meaning defeat people.
What he basically said in the long version was, We're the army right here. We're going to march to the polls, and we're going to take those bastards out. That's kind of what he said.
Perhaps,
a long version.
But the fact of the matter is,
we're all right about this. This is not the way you want to talk when you're introducing the President of the United States.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. No. I do not disagree at all.
And you can understand how the President was probably, and I'm guessing, but I suspect he winced a little bit when it was introduced that way, because I don't think the President is quite that dogmatic. Let's put it that way.
No, I agree. But he
doesn't use that kind of language.
No, it's not his style.
No. But I think I do see Alan's point. I think anytime you should tone it down a little bit, anytime you're introducing the head of state for America.
Of course.
And, yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. You cannot be associated. I agree with that. We're going to come up on our first break. We'll be back. When we come back, we want to talk about the Tea Party debate. Speaking of taking those people out, we're going to be talking about the Tea Party debate that happened in Tampa, Florida, a swing state, last night. Who were the winners? Who were the not-so-many winners? Three losers. And we'll talk about a couple of topics that came out of the debate last night, particularly one that's a little bit close to Alan's heart. But this is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. And we're back here in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, America's premier cigar tavern. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue our political discussion this afternoon. We want to talk about the Tea Party debate that happened in Tampa last night. Pretty much the entire Republican Party was up on stage debating the issues, but the focus seemed to be on the interaction between Governor Rick Perry out of Texas and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and second-time presidential candidate Mitt Romney, and then everybody else. But it was interesting how that played out. Unfortunately, a few of us did not see the debate in its entirety last night. I think I'm the only one, possibly. But we've all seen the highlights. The question is, did the debate last night kind of reinforce the idea that, in fact, this is a two-horse race, Perry and Romney? Al?
Yeah, of course it did. And the way they set it up, it had to be. You were mentioning before we went on the air that, and so was Alan, that that's the logical way to do it. But I think when you take the also-rans are never, ever going to have a shot at being anything but also-rans if you don't ever let them participate. And putting the two principal people right in the center, where they will attack each other and where they will get most of the questions and most of the comments, really is unfair, I think, to what remote chances other candidates might have of being able to make a point that could cast a spark and start something.
You know, I got to tell you something. One of the big things that I took away last night from that debate was Rick Perry, after a couple of shots, looked like a boxer just stunned. He just absolutely looked out of place. I don't think he knew which way was up. Am I the only one who got that impression, perhaps, Alan?
I didn't see it quite that way. I'm actually intrigued with the two things from the first debate to the second. The first debate, the members were all trying to kind of establish themselves, and there was some back and forth. This time, it was clear that they all wanted to take shots at the front runner, Perry,
right,
and also at Romney, who's the other front runner.
Right.
And one can argue, you know, who's truly in the lead, but let's acknowledge it's probably Perry at the moment. So bring down the big guy and the other big guy if you want to get any chance. So they were all coming after Perry. Now, having said that, what I also noticed was that because Perry took some shots the first time, Romney's been taking some shots.
Right.
These guys are getting better at taking the shots.
Right.
Practice matters. Look at Romney today compared to 4 years ago. He's really come a long way, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And how he presents himself, keeping cool, his response lines, etc. And I think, I didn't see Perry, quite the same way. I think he was a little surprised that everybody was coming after him sort of constantly. But he gave as well as he got.
Well, I tell you something. I didn't see it that way. I the way I saw it was, I don't think Rick Perry came fully prepared for the debate. I think that he kind of took some, the shots were made at Rick Perry, and it was almost like he had to shake it off and go, oh, wait a minute, I got to actually talk now. And his answers, if I were in the Perry camp, if I was part of that campaign, I think some of the answers were fractured. I think some of the answers weren't exactly poised the way I would want or expect a front runner candidate to pull off. Bob, am I wrong in that assessment?
Well, I looked at it a little bit differently. I mean, they were taking harder shots at the governor from Texas than was true in the earlier debate. But the fact of the matter is, I think that it's pretty difficult for the governor to be able to, let's just take Social Security for an issue, it's pretty hard to square the circle that he is trying to square. First of all, he says, the states ought to be running Social Security. It shouldn't be a federal program. Well, that's a pretty foolish idea. I mean, it's hard for me to understand how that can be a good idea. given the problems that the states have, given the fact that this has been a federal program for 75 years, how you're going to disassemble the program and put it and throw it into 50 states, I have no concept of how that could work. The fact of the matter is, it's a problem. Now, I don't care how he says, well, I really mean we just have to fix it like everybody else has been saying, which is what he's trying to do. But that's a cop-out. And that's the, if that's the best answer he can give as to how he thinks things ought to go, then he's really got a problem.
But it strikes me, Al, that that's a matter of preparation. I'm sure anytime you had a debate, you would at least, if you're going to have a platform like Rick Perry does and bringing Social Security, making it a state's responsibility as opposed to having it a federal responsibility, that your team would at least prep you for coming back on those shots.
You would think they would have spent all week trying to come up with something to deal with the Ponzi scheme remark.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he had to bring it up to shoot it down, it would have been something worth getting ahead of. Is that his fault, or is it his preparation people's fault?
I think it's a combination of both, Bob.
May I suggest that there isn't a good way to do it? I mean,
if you're going to bring up the Ponzi scheme,
he's out too far on this issue, and I don't think you can get back off the limb. He's way out on the limb, and I don't think he can get back on it.
You may be right.
It was interesting that with regard to the Ponzi scheme reference, which probably Ponzi is turning over in his grave, because the true Ponzi scheme was built on so-called profits. This is a social insurance system where everybody participates and then everybody earns benefits over a period of time. It is unaffordable because there aren't enough people who will be paying in over time to pay for all of those who have earned benefits, so you have to make changes to fix it. I don't think it's a great use of the word Ponzi scheme. However, I found it interesting that one of the ways he was trying to defend his use of the word Ponzi scheme was by saying, well, I'm not the first guy who called it a Ponzi scheme. Other people have. Well, okay, so a number of people have made poor use of this term. He also said last night, I want everybody who's now a beneficiary to know you're safe, you're good, you're solid. Well, okay, where does the money come from that pays their benefits? From a national
social insurance pool.
You can't change it and keep everything intact. So he is not now advocating turn it over to the states. In his book of only 6 months ago when it came out, he suggested that was something that we should really look at. He's backing away from that too, and it's fair game.
It's fair game in a debate.
To talk about it, but I think it's a little bit of an exaggeration to say he wants to take it to the states.
Absolutely,
he's running from all of it.
Absolutely, Bob.
It's a little bit interesting that he says last night we need to have a conversation, and the governor from Massachusetts comes out and says we're having a conversation now.
Right,
and it really got a lot of hoopla from the audience.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a great response.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was a response Romney would not have been capable of making four years ago.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I think the candidate in Mitt Romney that we saw last night is, I think we're going to see more and more of that develop, and I think that's what's going to be the downfall of Rick Perry being, I think the more and more secure that Governor Romney has in his own skin is going to be what's going to show in future debates. But when we talk about Rick Perry, remember, this guy has been saying stuff way out in left field since he took the governor's mansion in Austin. This is a guy who actually came out at one time publicly and said Texas should secede from the United States because of border and immigration control issues. Are you serious? That alone, and we haven't heard that come out yet. That is still, I think, an ace in the hole that somebody's going to say, if you want to be the head of this country, at one time you were advocating for your state to secede. That's not very presidential, Al.
One wonders if the fact that he comes from Texas, where they talk differently and to some degree think differently, and all of these are great lines in Texas. Then he moves out into the larger world, and they're not playing as well, and can he adapt? That's the question.
Well, the one
or
thing
is it too late for him to even try to address?
Well, I mean, you want to, let's say, for example, his foreign policy answers. I mean, what he was saying, you could have taken out of his playbook and put it into the White House. He didn't differ much from what the Obama White House is doing when it deals with, let's say, Afghanistan.
Well, and that's because the Obama White House hasn't differed very much from the
traditional Republican
policies that inherited from the Bush administration.
But in Mitt Romney's answers, in even John Huntsman's answers, even Michelle Bachmann, they all came out and separated themselves saying, this is how I would do it differently, something that Rick Perry has not been able to differentiate himself on, and I think that's going to be an Achilles heel for him.
It's interesting. Perry is clearly on the defensive because he's trying to get some distance between what he has said in the past and where he wants to be now. So he is trying to modify his views and explain while the others are on the attack, aggressively saying, this is what we do. This is how we handle it.
Which is funny because 4 years ago, it was Mitt Romney having to back away his stuff he said and his actions as governor of Massachusetts. That shoe is now firmly planted on Rick Perry. You're wincing a little bit at that one, Al.
No, I'm not wincing. I was thinking what Romney had to do was to try and suddenly become a conservative when he'd been a liberal governor. Rick Perry is a conservative governor and stays conservative. He's got a different problem than Romney had, I think. And he may be helping Romney by diverting attention away from Romney, has, you know, to use the term flip-flop, whatever
right.
you want. He's changed his positions on things. And if Romney can successfully keep Perry on the defensive, it'll all be about Perry and less about what Romney.
And we have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How you doing, sir? What are your thoughts?
Pretty good. Say again?
Go ahead, sir, with your thoughts.
I just wanted to say you were talking about the debate, and I saw most of it. I think Rick Perry looked like a wounded animal. I don't see him. I don't think he expected to get whacked the way he got whacked. I mean, it was almost like, you know, he looked like a deer in the headlights. You know, it was like, you know, we're all supposed to be civil. We're all Republicans here. And, you know, now these people are, you know, because everybody's been, you know, with the kid gloves so far. And all of a sudden, people were, you know, taking pretty big pot shots at him last night. So, you know, I don't think that he looked very presidential at all. I think he just looked like he was just sort of, he didn't know where he was. He wasn't ready for it. Maybe it was his lack of debating skill. I don't know, but that's the way it struck me, you know. And I think the whole process was like, the candidates speak of a wonderful, idyllic life. You know, Newt Gingrich with, you know, we don't need to raise revenue, we need to cut government. Well, it may be true we need to streamline government, but to cut government to where Newt wants to cut it, you won't have anything, you'll be boiling your water. And it's the same thing with the Ron Paul ideas, you know, because, I mean, Ron Paul will sit there and tell you that that we need to take responsibility. And the question that really hit home the best was, what do you do when Wolf Blitzer asked him, what do you do with the kid who's 30 years old, who feels invincible, doesn't get insurance, and then ends up in a car crash and in a coma? Do you let him die? And you hear the audience yelling out, yes. And then Ron said, well, we have churches. We have churches to take care of these things. Well, what is a church? A church is a collective group of individuals who appoint an administrator. What is the government? The government is a collective group of people who appoints an administrator. I mean, this becomes ridiculous. I mean, we're looking at the people who have existed before us, who have created Department of Education and EPA, and thinking that we're smarter than these people are. Now, I'm not saying that we don't need to change things and that we don't need to revise them to a certain degree. But if you remember when the Department of Education was founded, people in this country couldn't read and write. You know, so, I mean, it was a necessary thing. When Teddy Roosevelt put in, you know, fair practices for labor, people were in slave labor shops, and you'll still see it today if you go to Indonesia. So we need to, you know, be sensible about what we're doing. And everybody's talking about freedom as if there's no cost for freedom on either side. I mean, there's pros and cons on anything you do. You can say this is overregulated. You may be right. But what about what happens if you take the regulation away? Then what takes place? We've seen it happened under the Bush administration.
Alan,
I'm sorry,
Alan, you have a thought on the caller's comments?
Yeah. I think the caller is making a powerful case for flexibility, compromise, and balance as we go forward and deal with problems that we acknowledge exist. I was struck by his comments about Rick Perry. Perry does not have a lot of debate experience. He did fairly well in the first debate. I'm guessing he was feeling pretty good about that, a little bit cocky, and wasn't ready for the onslaught. In the meantime, the caller was describing it, it reminded me of this ultimate fighting, cage fighting, where of course I would never watch such a thing, but I've heard that what happens is that when they get a guy down, you just beat the living hell out of him so he can't get up. You finish him off. You don't let him up. There's, you know, there's no civil discourse there, especially when they're down. And I think what was happening is it was become a little bit self-fulfilling. He's feeling hurt, and then somebody else comes
in
the other side, and then here comes the left hand and the right foot, and he was limping at the end. But I think that he's shown in the past that this is not a stupid guy. And he's going to go back and watch this stuff and say, I need to be better prepared. I need my answers, especially on Social Security, on immigration, on state secession, and on this whole HPV business. These were the big issues where he was really struggling, and they just kept hitting him with one after the other.
You're saying he needs to go back and watch the film.
I think he does need to go back and watch the film with some smart advisors and say, what should I have done? What might I do next time? Take a page from your book, where sometimes he can take the initiative and not wait till he's hit, but he can bring up some of these subjects. Let me make clear what I believe about Social Security and why I've called it a Ponzi scheme. Let me talk about what the state has done in immigration and why.
Now,
I would just like to know where the caller is from.
Caller, where are you calling from today?
I'm from Florida.
Excellent. Well, caller, we appreciate great call. We appreciate your comments. Please keep listening to us. We hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for joining us today. You know, the caller was actually fantastic in the wounded animal. I mean, I got to tell you something. That pretty much sums up Rick Perry's performance last night there in Tampa. He definitely had to tap out. And when we talk about the IPV vaccination situation, you know, he didn't have an answer for that. He was all over the place.
Well, he's changed his policy. If I might just take a moment.
Absolutely.
HPV, human papillomavirus, causes cervical cancer in females. There is a drug made by Merck called Gardasil that if you take three shots, and they're kind of expensive, if you take those shots, you will be protected as a young girl for about 70-80% of the HPV possible infections. You don't get HPV, you don't get cervical cancer. There is a direct link. There's a number of states who require girls to get those shots while they're in middle school. And the state of Virginia is one of them.
Right.
State of Texas was another, but they got there different ways. In the state of Virginia, the legislature made the decision, and they informed parents that this is a requirement. They allow parents to decide not to give their kid this.
The opt-out.
There's an opt-out provision that families are allowed to follow, and they're still allowed in the schools. What Perry did in Texas, and where he's backing away, is by executive order, he imposed a policy much like the Virginia policy and a handful of other states. He had the misfortune of taking a $5,000 campaign contribution from Merck at the same time, which prompted this part of the exchange with Michelle Bachmann. He's basically said, as I understand it, yeah, I believe that the fight against cancer is important. When you've got a life-saving medication, we should pay attention and we should encourage its use. I probably should have done it a different way. I had a bigger problem last night with what Michelle Bachmann was saying. Now, she was the aggressor here and basically saying, how dare you? How dare you tell families that they should do this? Well, there's a big challenge in this world. Do you allow people to opt out, or do you require people to opt in and make the choice? But the bigger problem with Bachmann, the bigger problem with what Michelle Bachmann said was what do we know about this vaccine? And vaccines have...
Let me give you the exact quote that she said. And I'm quoting Michelle Bachmann's statement on this exact subject. Quote, to have an innocent little 12-year-old girl be forced to have a government injection through an executive order is just wrong. Little girls who have a negative reaction to this potentially dangerous drug don't get a mulligan, unquote. You think that that's inaccurate?
Well, I think that virtually all public health professionals say this is a good thing. This is a health. Has a positive impact on broader public health. It's a good thing. They're not saying you should require it. It's not a contagious disease like a measles, where a kid with measles can infect other kids. This is a very individual thing. It's a sexually transmitted disease. You can get protection. I think parents should have the right to say no. But what Bachmann was saying was raising questions that most public health officials would say are just dead wrong about the risks of this particular vaccine. And I think that is a disservice to parents and kids.
Well, Michelle Bachmann has always had problems with facts.
Well, that's true. She may have been speaking somewhat truth, but it's always been incomplete in Michelle Bachmann's world. The one thing I do want to point out is the Texas situation was kind of unique, and I think this is something that was brought out last night by Michelle Bachmann, is that Texas instituted the Merck drug as state policy, and then the governor turns around and appoints Merck's chief lobbyist in Austin as his chief of staff in the governor's office. That's got to have a little bit of a connotation that says something doesn't smell quite kosher.
There's another aspect of this, and I'm changing the subject slightly. There are implications to health care costs in this. While the inoculations are expensive, as Alan pointed out, it's a lot less expensive than having to deal with cancer. Which can cost thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Is there a certain hypocrisy in the policy that Governor Perry instituted in Texas and him coming out and saying that our health care costs, Obamacare, is an abomination, for lack of a better term, when it comes to health care costs?
Well, that may be a bigger question than I can handle, but I'll say one thing. Alan is exactly right. The key point here is the governor of Texas did it by executive order. The legislature was not involved. This is a matter, if you're going to do it something like this, you've got to let the legislature do it. You've got to have an opt-out if someone doesn't do it, if doesn't want to do it, but it ought to be available. When the states do it, it ought to be done on a state program. It ought to be a statute. Otherwise, you run into the exact problem. Perry may have been doing exactly the right thing, but it looks as though Merck and their contribution and his relationship with their lobbyist and all this came into play in his decision making, rather than deciding it the way it should be decided in the state legislature with certain opportunities for the parents to decide if they don't want to do it.
But I think what we're doing is we're calling into question the idea that there's I don't want to call it a hypocrisy, but that's the only way we can go in his arguments against the Obama healthcare program, when he himself signed an executive order that cost the taxpayers of Texas tens of millions of dollars. For the right reason or not, you can't stand up on a stage in Tampa and say Obamacare is absolutely abhorrent and then turn around and have your record show, hey, you know what, I spent tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money to help increase the health of young women in the state of Texas.
Yeah, and there's another reason for the opt-out that Virginia has, and that is that that some religions, Christian Scientists come to mind right off the
Quakers,
bat.
Quakers, I think.
Quakers, yeah.
That will have a religious objection to it, and they ought to be able to exercise that freedom. But the idea, Virginia has done it right, and it should be the example that other states follow.
I don't think there's any question that the intention and the way Virginia did it was right, but to sign an overarching executive order coming out saying you will do this regardless of religion, and by the way, parents, you have no say in the care of your children.
No, there is opt-out. There is an opt-out.
In the Texas executive order?
Yes, there is. The Texans have an opt-out. They have an opt-out, but there's a big debate about opt-out versus opt-in because people tend to follow whatever the order is, and they may or may not understand what this three-part injection is and what hoops they have to jump through to not do it. So there's not the kind of education of parents and families that you would want in an opt-in type program, although the Virginia one, you get it, you're allowed to opt out. There's just a huge duty to educate and encourage.
And I agree, but I also would be for the opt out rather than opt in, because it's that.
Well, not necessarily. I think the opt in
with the education that Alan's talking about.
No, but I think the opt in puts the responsibility back to the parent versus the responsibility back to the state.
Well,
the opt-out says, this is my order, you're going to do this. You have the opportunity to say, nah, maybe not. But in an opt-in, it leaves that decision to the people who have the best interest of the child at play.
But it also leaves the state, in the long run, and in the government, with higher medical costs.
Yeah. Why would an opt-in versus an opt-out,
I would think? Al is right here. When you have opt-out versus opt-in, the opt-out gives a much, much higher rate of acceptance than the opt-in. When you have to assertively do something, people tend to be hesitant and back away. If you have to, so most people will go along. The state does have an interest here, as Al also says, because this is a public health issue. It's personal and it's public health. If we can reduce the rate of HPV among boys, girls, men, and women, all of society will benefit. That's why it's a legitimate issue for governments to wrestle with.
I agree with you that it is a public health issue. There's no question about it. However, when we look at the right of the parent to justify in their mind, it becomes an educational issue. It is the responsibility of the state, if they're going to do something like this, to educate the parents to say, you want to opt in on this. This is for the betterment of your child. To say that, you know, you're going to do this, but you have the choice to opt out, I think takes it out of the hands of the parent inherently. I disagree.
It doesn't take it out of the hands. It does nudge it in a different direction.
But
there is
the
a legitimate
state,
policy
state,
debate.
It's not the state's responsibility to nudge.
I disagree.
The state has an interest.
It has
a public health interest.
It's a public health interest.
And a financial
example,
interest.
The state laws that say motorcyclists must wear helmets. And some motorcycle riders say that's infringing my right.
I agree.
But I have been in a brain damage center where an incredible percentage of the people that were there were in motorcycle accidents and being taken care of by the state.
Yes, words of the state.
But I would argue that says, look, there has to be a personal responsibility at hand in this. I look at the Florida helmet law. The Florida helmet...
Not if they're going to take my tax dollars to pay for their irresponsibility.
But what are the cases? A majority of people that are riding... I know a majority of the Harley riders, I'm sure, are riding around with insurance that covers that. I would venture to say that people riding around on expensive motorcycles that choose to not wear a helmet, that's at their own personal risk. again, I go back to the Florida helmet law. For years, the state of Florida mandated helmets on motorcycles. The motorcycle advocacy groups came back and said, look, my choice to ride a motorcycle without a helmet is my choice. You can't tell me. If I make a stupid decision, trust me, if I'm riding a motorcycle, I'm wearing a helmet because I've been on enough motor vehicle accidents to see what that does.
This goes right back to the point that Ron Paul was making last night with respect to, so, you know, to medical care. You know, if what's the answer if you're riding around on a motorcycle and you decide not to wear a helmet, you don't have any insurance, and you get injured in an accident, you may have a right not to wear a helmet, but then does the state have an obligation to handle your medical expenses for the next 20 years?
The state doesn't have a responsibility. Well, I made that choice.
Well, the point is that isn't the way it works now. So you want to throw those people and say, okay, we're not going to take care of you, and let them lay there in a hospital bed with no care,
die? They can't stay in the hospital, but that costs money.
No, they'll go home.
They lie beside the road.
Okay. You know, I think we're drawing it out to an obscure...
No,
this is not the way our system works. This is why one of the reasons our health system is going bankrupt. When people say we have all these uninsured people in America, people without health care, well, frankly, most people have some access to health care. They go to a hospital emergency room and they have to be treated. That doesn't mean the hospital gets paid. They have to be treated. And I think that's a good thing that we have. It's a very expensive thing. And the same thing would hold for the motorcycle rider who rode without a helmet, didn't have insurance, was smashed up along the side of the road, picked up in an ambulance.
Well, wait a minute,
You're talking about
a mandate that says you have to have insurance to ride a motorcycle and you have to have a helmet on. Those are two very distinct. I agree that if you're going to ride a motorcycle in the District of Columbia, you need to have insurance. You have to have insurance because you can do something stupid and hurt other people. Okay. I think that's one separate item. The helmet item is another issue.
What I was saying is there are a lot of people riding motorcycles without helmets, without insurance. And the state must, under federal law, and the hospitals must, under federal law,
agreed,
take those people in.
Agreed.
That is the state's interest. That is why the state has an interest in both requiring insurance and requiring helmets, or for that matter, why the federal government requires seatbelts in cars.
But they also do the same set of arguments. They also require insurance. When you get pulled over, the first thing they ask you is, do you have your registration, your driver's license? Do you have your valid insurance card? You have to have insurance to drive a car in just about every state.
You're driving your motorcycle without a helmet and you have an accident and you're lying there dying and the policeman says, do you have insurance? Come on.
I disagree.
There are lots of uninsured motorists.
Yeah, there are
autos,
tons of them.
And motorcycles.
And they are treated in emergency rooms across this
all
country.
All the time.
Yep. All the time. But to say that, to make a de facto law that says whether it's a helmet law, whether a de facto element that nudges people to force their 12 or strongly encourage through executive order their 12-year-old daughter. And let me be clear about one thing. I am not against the HPV injections. I'm absolutely in favor of it. I think it's not from a healthcare cost. I'm looking at it just for the safety of the little girl. But
off this specific subject, I am sitting here thinking we all sound like a bunch of constitutional lawyers trying to decide whether there should be a personal mandate in healthcare.
Wow. Bob, we're going to take a break.
Isn't that amazing?
We're going to take a break on that subject. We'll talk about that off air. And by the way, it's happy hour.
If we don't take a break, I'm going to call a vote.
And by the way, it's happy hour. We got to order martinis, wine, beer, and Jack Daniel.
Yeah, right.
Get our cigars lit up for the last hour of Backroom Politics. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. live here in Washington, D.C. at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital.
With John McLaughlin, who's our moderator today.
I take that, you know what, I take that as a compliment. Thank you, Congressman.
I thought you would.
I do, I absolutely do. Wrong!
It wasn't a compliment.
Oh, okay. I liked it.
He decided to forego the moderator role.
Yeah. Yeah. As John McLaughlin obviously does from time to time. Anyway, for those of you joining us for our second hour, it is happy hour. We've just ordered our martinis, our Jack Daniels, and our beers and wine. And we've lit up our cigars for the last hour. But continuing the conversation from our first hour, we were talking about the debate last night in Tampa, Florida, for the Republicans, where there was basically a pig pile on Governor Rick Perry last night. He obviously had the, for lack of a better term, the target painted on his back. There was almost a wounded animal, as one caller put it, looked to him. He looked like a punch-drunk boxer in other instances. But there were other players in the game last night. Obviously, we talked about Michelle Bachmann. Michelle Bachmann called out Governor Perry on his executive order for the HPV injections being used in the state of Texas. But there was also other players, namely people like Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum, I thought, looked actually pretty good last night. He started taking shots at Michelle Bachmann early. He took a lot of what you were saying last night, Alan, or what you were saying just now, Alan. He actually went after Michelle Bachmann on the same issues. He's definitely still in the game, I think. But here's the question is, can somebody like a Rick Santorum remain in the race, even though he had a good showing? Does he even have a chance of surviving through maybe, let's say, January? Al?
No.
No? Bob?
No.
Alan?
You know, it all depends on what you mean by survival.
Can his campaign, will he be a candidate for the presidency come January?
You know, I don't know. He's a marginal candidate now. He's not spending much money. He's not raising much money. Sometimes people kind of limp along. Will he be a credible candidate? Is it possible for me to see him being a candidate? No. I don't know when he'll drop out. He's a very interesting guy. I knew him a little bit in my days in the Senate. I actually have a lot of admiration for him. But if you want to find a guy who has said some dumb things,
Rick Santorum?
Rick Santorum has said some dumb things. Now, there's no reason for the other candidates to pay any attention to that because he is so marginal. If he started to rise, all of the unfortunate things he has said in the past would loom up and he would be smashed back down.
So as quickly as he would rise up after last night's performance, he would be dragged down with a lot of the other stuff.
That's my sense of it. We can't totally figure out what it is that causes some people to rise, some people to fall, some people never to gain traction. I don't see him gaining traction. When he drops out, I don't know.
When you look at them all up there, you figure you got two front runners, and let's just assume that maybe there's four. The rest are dead men walking.
Well, let's say for example,
we don't know which are the dead men.
Well, let's say for example, Ron Paul. Ron Paul has been going after Rick Perry in advertisements, calling out his relationship. I mean, let's be real. Rick Perry was a Democrat before he flipped over to the Republican Party because it was arguably in his political favor to do so.
And it wasn't so long ago either.
Right. I mean, there's still pictures of Rick Perry and Al Gore locked arm in arm in Austin, Texas. But that doesn't seem, I mean, it was called out a little bit. In fact, it was Rick Santorum that called it out the most, I think. But is that something that's going to come back and bite him closer we get to Ames, or the Iowa caucuses, or
come back and bite whom?
Bite Rick Perry in the rear end. The fact that he was a Democrat flipped over to the Republican Party for political benefit.
Well, given the nature of the extreme right Republican faction, they probably will find that very, very hard to swallow. I think it's nonsense.
I'm not sure they would find it hard to swallow. I think that conservatives like people who are seeking redemption from past mistakes. I mean, you see this all the time with their willingness to accept even if the religious ones, people who have, in a religious way, for example, sinned somehow and come back seeking redemption. I don't know that this in any way disqualifies him. It may, but I don't think that's the traction against him yet. And it also, might, in an odd way, might make him on some of his views be a little more appealing to some Democrats.
Bob,
I agree completely. The fact that, you know, I would remind our listeners and ourselves, Ronald Reagan was a Democrat.
That's true.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, people change their minds over time. People, if, you know, issues come up that are different, times are different, attitudes are different. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with changing parties if you do it for illegitimate reasons. He has been a successful governor in a major state. He has a good story to tell on jobs and other things of that nature. He's done a good job. Now, he's a pretty effective candidate. I don't think he's going to get the nomination because I think he's said some things which I think he's going to have a very hard time answering. But I don't think the fact that he was an active Democrat for Al Gore in the 2004
election. 2011.
It was before that.
I thought it was
88.
I think it may have been 88. I think Alan's right. When he originally ran for the state house in Austin, he was a Democrat. He flipped when he went to run for a statewide post is when he went Republican, knowing that Texas is pretty much one big red state.
This was over 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, Gore ran for president in what, 2000?
Against Bush.
That's when Kerry was working for him.
No, I think
you may be inaccurate on that.
It was earlier than that.
I think this was back.
This was one of Al Gore's first, because he, at that time,
he was involved
in the state Democratic chairing of Gore's campaign back then.
Point. Yeah. Whatever that is, it is, and we can find that out. I completely agree with Bob that it shouldn't make any difference. However, I'm not as sanguine as Alan is that the Tea Party people are going to be that forgiving of it because they are so rigid.
Well, they love him right now. A lot of them
It's not like it's a secret.
No, but the only person who's calling that out, I mean, literally, Ron Paul has been buying TV ad time in Texas, calling Governor Perry a Democrat.
Well, remind yourselves that a lot of the Tea Party people, the things that they're supporting, smaller governments, less regulation, get the government out of our hair, cut taxes, that's the kind of stuff that the Reagan Democrats were. Think about that.
All right.
So we're talking about a group of people who probably themselves have from time to time had different viewpoints.
But let's be clear about one thing, though. Let's be clear about one thing. We have to remind everybody and remind ourselves that when Ronald Reagan switched from Democrat to Republican, all he was a vocal mouthpiece for General Electric. It was when he ran as a Republican.
That's true.
When Rick Perry first elected office in the state of Texas, he ran on a Democratic ticket. That is the big difference.
More than once.
And was elected as a Democrat. When he went for statewide office is when he finally realized, I have got to do something about this. That's my problem with calling and switching and flip-flopping. If you're going to come out and say that Mitt Romney waffles, guess what? Rick Perry waffles as much as anybody. And he's got the record to show it.
Do you remember a U.S. Senator named Phil Graham, also from Texas and all places? Do you remember that he was in the House?
Oh, do I remember that. I sat next to him on the committee.
He was your fellow Democrat.
I know. Cause
he was your fellow Democrat.
He was sitting there trying to mark up a bill, and I'm watching him draw all kinds of designs on napkins to demonstrate his economic theories to me.
Graham Rudman.
Exactly.
Phil Graham then switched parties.
because he had to run for a statewide elected office.
No. He switched parties, and then he went back home, and he ran for his seat as a Republican and
that's
won.
That's right. You're right.
It was a very courageous, gutsy move.
It was.
It worked. And he became a senator, a very conservative senator. He ran for president, didn't get any traction.
And protected him from the switch argument.
So there are, in our history of politics, it's not just Ronald Reagan who was, on TV for General Electric. There have been elected politicians who've switched. Some of them, in at times, it seemed pretty transparent. There were some people who switched in order to try to hang on to their political career. Arlen Specter's name comes to mind, who was a born-again Democrat at the age of 72.
Joe Lieberman did
Senator Shelby.
Dick Shelby was another one.
Yes.
Lieberman, he switched independent, and he still caucuses with the Democrats because he thought, I think I can beat this Democrat who beat me in the narrow primary, and I'm going to run as an independent. Well, lo and behold, he prevailed.
The other player in this is John Huntsman, and John Huntsman apparently has absolutely no finger on any pulse of pop culture to speak of. He tried quoting a song by the grunge rock group Nirvana, and said it was and attributed all apologies to the group Nirvana. That is wrong. He's been called out on it now that it's a minor thing, but still, if you're going to call something out in a debate, they're going to jump on it in the media.
Talking about switching parties, given Obama's standing and Huntsman's standing, maybe it's time for him to switch to a Democrat. He might do well there.
He might do well in the Democratic Party. Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain, are they so on the fringe right now, saying we're talking about them?
Yeah, I
think in the case of Herman Cain, that's a little sad. In that he
but
makes
not in the case of Gingrich.
He makes a lot of sense. I don't agree with a lot of his stuff, but he's a very articulate and thoughtful guy, and he's just not getting any traction. In part, I suspect, because he's black, but not exclusively. It's also because the media puts him at the end of the line where
right.
he doesn't get the questions.
Al has mentioned Cain's race here and thinks that may be a factor. Santorum's white. He's been a U.S. senator. He's got no traction. Cain's got no traction because he's got no traction.
I agree with Alan on this one. But I will say this. I don't think we've seen the last of Herman Cain in the political arena. I would venture to say that we will probably see him either as a U.S. representative to Congress or as possibly a U.S. senator down the road.
Whereas I think we are watching the end of
Rick Santorum's political career is going down.
And
Newt Gingrich is done.
We're not watching the end. We've seen the end.
Yeah. This is just him.
Years ago. this is like one of those horror movies that's over, but then a hand comes up out of the soil. And it's like, what's that?
Oh, we got to snoo
it. And you listen, he's not. He's a smart guy, but he's so history politically. Talk about a guy who's made a bunch of mistakes that people can ignore because they're irrelevant.
Bob, you had a comment on Newt.
I just want to say one thing, not on Newt, but on Mr. Cain. I have yet to hear him say anything foolish or silly or unintelligent. He's a bright man. He's a good businessman. He's articulate. He's got
pizzas suck.
Well, that I don't know.
His pizzas are garbage. But he's made a lot of money off those bad pizzas.
But
reason to be against it right there.
Have you gone to a Godfather's Pizza? My God, they're horrible. But I am biased. Family comes from New York. I come from the Northeast where we have good pizza.
But I think the guy is a pretty smart guy, and I think that he is, I don't know if he has a future in politics, but I have been impressed by him every time he says something. It makes some sense.
You know,
but he has no traction.
I will tell you that, you know, when we see something like Herman Cain, and I absolutely agree with you, Bob. I think every time I've heard him, he is a dynamic speaker. You know, there are, you know, and I hate to categorize him as African American, black, or whatever, but when you see him speak and you see the energy that he brings to a crowd, I go back to when he made his announcement, and that announcement was so dynamic. It actually made me think, wow, you know, I could get behind this guy, not knowing the fact that he has absolutely no influence inside the Beltway. I would venture to say we have not seen the last of Herman Cain on the national political front. Whether it's if the Republicans come in, he may be a good cabinet choice, or, you know, seeking elective office out of Michigan. I think we will see him again and again, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think he's a very talented man.
I think he's got, I agree. Alan?
Since we're still talking about yesterday's debate, there was one other issue that Perry got beat up on and seems likely to continue to get beat on, and that's the...
immigration?
It's an immigration-related issue. He took what I think was quite a courageous stand and supported the idea that kids of illegal immigrants who had a clean record, went through the public school system, and are ready for college, and admitted to college.
Born in the United States.
I don't know if they had to be born here or not. I'm not sure about that one.
Right.
But they grew up here. They were raised here, and came here as, if they weren't born here, came here as very small children, that they should be able to get in-state tuition. They've always lived there, and there's no
question about... They've gone to public schools.
And they've gone to public schools. Well, this is a very controversial issue, and it took a lot of courage on his behalf to say they should get in-state tuition. Now he's backing away from that one a bit too, because that does not comport with the view of some conservatives that if you're fruit of a poisonous tree, if your parents are illegals and you're the fruit of their relationship, their sins should be hoisted upon you. I find it, I was reflecting on this. I mean, I like his policy, frankly. I'm supportive of it. I think that in other states that there's plenty of room for kids who've gone through the public schools, lived in a particular state, to not only be able to go to college there, but I'd like to think they could get papers and get hired. I mean,
right.
he doesn't support letting them get hired, but that's a different issue. But I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, in America, if your parents are citizens and you grow up here, and your let's say your father is just a bad guy, rapist, robber, murderer,
all those good things,
that won't affect the kid's rights. The kid, if he goes through school, can get in-state tuition. It's only the sin of being the child of illegal immigrants that would prevent you from that. I think that's just wrong. I like his policy on that one. I'm sorry he's backing away from it under the pressure of Republicans and conservatives. And I'm sorry to see him back away.
I think Alan is exactly right in what he says and why he supports it. It strikes me that this is one of the interesting things about primary seasons. I mean, we have spent the last better part of an hour beating the governor over the head for one reason or another. This is an example of why politics in America is so interesting, because, you know, there are so many different issues, there are so many different kinds of issues, and nobody is, if they're smart, is totally down the line one way or another. If you're a good politician, if you're a talented politician, you have a broader mind than that. And this is an example of a guy who is very conservative in his politics in a lot of ways, but he also sees what's right and what's the right thing to do for all these young people who, for no fault of their own, are in a situation where they're now outside looking in, unless he does something about it. And he's trying to make these people the very best citizens they can be. Get a good education, have an opportunity to live the American dream, and I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think it's a good thing, and I think I admire the governor for that.
Congressman.
I agree with Bob on that. I was thinking of something else, which does not presently occur to me.
Oh, okay. There we go. We got that going for us. You know, the one thing I do want to say about Rick Perry is...
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
The thought that I was thinking about is this, that this whole immigration thing is a one-generation thing. It's got to be dealt with. It's a difficult thing to deal with, but it is not as though all of these illegal immigrants and legal immigrants are going to be unable to speak English, unable to read English, unable to get jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in perpetuity. Because as the whole history of immigration in this country is that your parents may not ever speak without a broken English, but the kids speak beautifully.
Right.
And it's a one-generation issue, and we should be dealing with it that way and dealing with some of the issues that are there.
I think one of the things that we have to point out, though, is, and I think this is one of the issues that circles around Governor Perry, is there's no question that Governor Perry has done some very intelligent things as governor and chief executive of the state of Texas. No question. He thinks like a Texan, he walks like a Texan, he talks like a Texan. When you get to that national level where you have to consolidate the national interest, in this case of your party, those executive decisions, gutsy as they may be, you can either have the courage to stand by them and roll the dice and say, you know what, I stand by this, I'm proud of this, or you can flip-flop, waffle, and come back and say, well, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I think the one thing that points out is, especially in the issue with HPV, especially with the issue of in-state tuition to the children of illegals, he had an opportunity to actually come out and show political courage. He did not. And that, to me, is not presidential. Mitt Romney has never come out and said, well, you know, my health care bill in Massachusetts was a bad idea, I'm going to back away. All he did was say that it was a good idea in representing, and it was my responsibility as the chief executive of Massachusetts to do so. I put something in that works for Massachusetts. Right, wrong, or indifferent, he stood by that. That is the type of, and not just him, there's other examples of that we've seen in other elections. We need somebody who's going to have political courage. That's presidential, not waffling. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to see. Rick Perry's either going to have to stand up and stand by his decisions, or it's not going to work.
And something you said there made me think about George Bush. Perry is a Texan. So is George Bush. George Bush graduated from Ivy League colleges. He's a much broader man, I think, in terms of his knowledge of the country. And I think it was his...
And remember who his father was. A lifelong public servant.
And his grandfather was U.S. Senator.
Right, of course.
But my point was, his total political experience was... His total experience wasn't just in Texas.
Correct.
And Perry is a Texan, and it's hard to find... where he's anything more, and that could be a very limiting factor for him.
I think we're going to see more and more of that hop out as we go through the course of these debates, that he's going to be so focused on Texas that he's going to have to start broadening his horizons a little bit, that the country itself is not Texas. And I think that's something that's got to change real quick.
And I don't know whether that's possible. I mean, there's something about Texas Texans that is almost immutable. And it wasn't true of George Bush, but it may be true of Rick Perry.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we want to talk about two special elections that are happening today as we speak. The special election to replace Congressman Twitter. Congressman Wiener in the New York 9th in the New York 9th district. There's also a special election going on in Nevada's 2nd congressional district. We're going to talk about the implications of those elections when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
down. Down, 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 down. Down, down, down. Why don't I go down?
And we're back, and I've got blood coming from my nose where I just got tagged by our distinguished panel. But we're live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to talk real quickly for about 10 minutes about the special elections going on in Nevada's 2nd Congressional District. But the one that's got everybody's attention right now is what is going on in New York's 9th Congressional District. The election there has got some implications, but it almost seems like it's a lame duck seat. This is to replace former Congressman Anthony Weiner. It is a race between Bob Turner and the Democrat David Werpen. Politico calls it a dysfunctional campaign at best, but it obviously has some implications. Number one, this is the seat that has been formerly held by, obviously, Anthony Weiner. It is the former seat of Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. It is the former seat of Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It is a very high-visibility seat, which includes a majority, what they call the Queens Boulevard political scene. But it looks like this could go Republican if Bob Turner pulls this off. Is that a sign of things to come in 2012? Bob?
I doubt it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I doubt it. It's a seat that is going to disappear. This gentleman is, if the Republicans win, it will be, I don't think it will be as significant as Scott Brown. It will be significant in this sense. I mean,
by the way, there was breaking news earlier, the fact that Senator Brown now has some competition.
Oh, yeah.
in his Senate seat. Major, that's going to be interesting.
Major competition.
Interesting development.
But I think it will be, obviously, the Republicans will be able to have another notch on their totem pole, so to speak, because they will have taken a seat that was the seat of the former vice presidential nominee,
Geraldine Ferraro.
It was the congressional seat of a major player in the Senate, Senator Chuck Schumer.
It gives him bragging rights for 2 weeks.
It gives him bragging rights. And I think from that standpoint, it will be a shot. But remind yourself, this is a district that, because New York is losing some seats in the redistricting, this seat, and because Mr. Weiner had resigned, redistricting is removing this seat from existence. So whoever wins is going to be a congressperson for about
16 months. Really? Al, do you think that New York 9 is going to have any implications of what we might see in 2012?
No, I don't. I think these individual elections that occur in various places do what I just said. It gives the party that wins about 2 weeks' worth of bragging rights. Unlike the flip
Brown
in Massachusetts, which was very solid and very important.
And it was Ted Kennedy's seat, which really moved.
Right.
So I think this is this will pass away.
Right. Alan?
Yeah. Whoever wins, and the Democrat could still win here, the winner will be a one-hit wonder. The seat will be gone. The person will have some months. I think Al is awfully optimistic if he thinks this is 2 weeks of bragging rights. I think it might be a couple of hours, maybe 2 days of bragging rights. It's it's a disappearing seat, as Bob has said, and it's a very, very unusual situation. So unusual that I think it's impossible to draw any broader conclusion.
I revise my thinking, and I agree with that.
Well, here's the great thing about it is I'm going to disagree with you all. I think that this does.
You've been doing that all day long.
Well, we got to have good radio somehow. It just has to be something I've got some sort of intelligence about. The thing about it is, if you look at that district, I mean, you look at where the heart of that political base is. It's in places like Forest Hills. It's in places like Rego Park. These are traditionally conservative, whether you want to call the Russian Front. Traditionally, it has been conservative Republicans that have always elected those types of New York-based Democrats that can understand, that can read the room, if you will, of their electorate. We've seen times when Chuck Schumer, one of the most liberal people in the House, in the Senate, has actually done some fairly conservative things when it comes to economics, jobs. He's done some very conservative things when it comes to national security. We saw it with Geraldine Ferraro. I think we saw it with Anthony Weiner. I think what you're seeing now is there is such a disillusion of the conservative Democratic base in a place like New York 9th that you're going to see for the first time a congressional seat inside the five boroughs start leaning more Republican than Democrat. And it's going to be interesting to see. I just know those people. Just for the record, my brother and my sister-in-law, raging liberals, live in Forest Hills. I look at their neighbors. These are hardworking, middle-class people. This is bridge and tunnel crowd. This is not the flaming liberal left of the Upper West Side. I think that we're going to see more and more of those types of blue-collar, middle-income districts that would tend to go straight party Democrat move a little bit further into opening up the seats. I don't think the Republicans are going to look at them necessarily as dead districts off the bat. I think they're going to take some serious looks at it. I think that's going to be an interesting play for 2012.
Let's face it. I mean, we got the whole Wiener business and the embarrassment of that and the unusual aspect of that. You are absolutely right. There is an enormous amount of disillusion among Democrats towards the president, and that will be part. That will be affected by turnout and by the vote. Whether it's no matter who wins, but I think it's just. This far out from the election, it's really, really dangerous to start drawing too many conclusions.
Too many
things will happen.
But I think this is something that, you know, normally, I mean, just the fact that we're talking about the New York 9th Congressional District and a possible Republican in that seat says buttloads about what's happening with the electorate and what has been traditional Democratic stronghold. I think you're going to see these are Rudy Giuliani, Michael Bloomberg Democrats, and they're going to start seeing more. We're going to see a more stronger voice of the moderates in the Republican Party that hopefully in 2012 will trump some of the Tea Party rhetoric. That's my hope. I think this election could prove to the RNC and the RNCC. We got to start looking at changing the voice of what we're coming out forward with.
From your voice to God's ear.
You know, we saw it with Scott Brown. We saw it with Scott Brown, and the RNC had an opportunity to cash in on that. They didn't. We have an opportunity now in New York 9th to cash in on that opportunity and become more moderate, more like the traditional base of what we want to go to. If we miss this opportunity, then that's the party's fault.
One of the things that we haven't really talked about is that it's so easy to figure out how weak the president is. I mean, the polls are easy to do, and it's a single kind of thing. The polls on the Congress, not just the Republicans. The Republicans are in very bad shape in the Congress as a whole, but that doesn't play out the same way as it does with a presidential candidate where you've got a single candidate. I think you're going to see, and I should save this for my tell me a story, But I think you're going to see a lot of incumbents, both parties...
In danger,
because the public, I think, is beginning to figure out that the Congress doesn't work, and they're going to start... It's kind of a throw-the-rascals-out kind of attitude that they're going to have.
I don't disagree. But the funny thing about it is we look at what's happening in Nevada second. Should have been a closer race than it is. It looks like it's going to be a runaway for the Republicans, which is shocking.
And I'm not saying every incumbent is going to lose. There are a lot of districts in which it's almost impossible for the incumbent to lose. But I think even there you're going to see some surprises, and in those more marginal districts. If I were an incumbent from a marginal district, I would be working my tail off because I think I would be
Alan.
No, I was going to say some of those incumbents are vulnerable to primary races simply because they're incumbents. So you may have a district that is drawn up to protect a Democrat or to protect a Republican, but not necessarily the incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw some of this last time, and we may see some of that this time. There's opportunities to attack incumbents from inside their parties. I'm not smart enough to know nationwide where those opportunities exist and what could happen. But that's another factor that could.
This segues into you look at what's happening in New York 9th. You look at the type of people that are in that district, Russian, Irish, Jewish, they tend to be very vocal, very active. When you look at that electorate, you know, you would think that something like the Obama Jobs Bill, which would have driven them straight back to the Democratic Party, did the Jobs Bill have an effect in maybe how they're looking at this? Was the Jobs Bill that strong?
No, I think if you went and did a poll of what's in the jobs bill, you could probably do a poll around this table. But I'm not suggesting that. But if you did a national poll, what's in that bill? You'd come up with a hodgepodge of misinformation and bad ideas. I didn't think it was a horrible speech, but it was a very political speech. And when you say 17 different times, pass this bill, this bill, which, when he gave the speech, did not yet exist.
Right. And it hadn't even gone up to the Hill.
It hadn't been written, and the details weren't laid out yet, and they were still being finalized. And then he said, we're going to pay for it. Well, part of the deal here is, here's all these things that we want to do, and some of them have had, or maybe all of them have had at some time or other, some level of Republican support. So what? What does that mean? If a handful of people at some point said, I think this is a good idea in the current context. There was a lot of exaggeration in the speech, but the biggest problem he's going to face is when he says, well, it's all going to be paid for, and now that we see the pay-for part, it's all taxes that he's proposing. So, you know, people said it was dead on arrival. I wasn't convinced before the fact that it was dead on arrival, but I think the full package is not going to move in this way. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be some things that will get done. Republicans care about this economy too, and they care about people working and about their own. They care, believe it or not, most politicians care mostly about their country. Second most re-election, but not first most re-election like a lot of the public believes. But I think it was a day late. There wasn't any enthusiasm around it. It was kind of a bizarre response in the room that night. So it'll be interesting. I think the action is there will be some action on a jobs bill, and I don't know what will occur. The real action is going to be over in the super committee.
Yeah, but Al, go ahead.
What gives me some hope, and I must admit this is just a hope, but he at least took the fight to the Republicans.
Did he though?
Yes, I think so. And passed the bill now. There's a number of hooks that he left out there that he can work on, and we'll see what he does now. I think whether that speech turns out to have been a good speech or a bad speech politically is going to depend on how his follow-up is.
There's
if he can follow it up with some fiery rhetoric and so forth, it may turn out to be a turning point. If he doesn't follow it up,
do you think that there was substance in what he was saying versus what's actually going to come up on the Hill?
I think the important thing was that he was taking on the Republicans, and it's the one thing he has not done. It's one thing that the Democrats have been wanting him to do. It is one of the things that usually works. I mean, it usually works. It's one of the things that can work, is a better way to put it. And as I said, it depends on the follow-up. If he continues that kind of approach, I think he has a chance of pulling it out.
Bob?
Almost immediately after the president's speech, Republican leadership was saying there are some good ideas in it we can talk about.
Infrastructure being one of them?
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, I think the bill is absolutely dead on arrival. As the president wants to pass this bill, you know, don't play around with it, don't fiddle with it, just pass the bill I'm going to send up there. That's not going to happen.
That's,
no chance at all.
That's my argument. That's what he's setting the Republicans in my dreams. That's what he's setting the Republicans up to do. They spent the whole time causing all kinds of problems with the debt ceiling. And if he can now get them cornered where they're going to behave similarly on this one, and he can hammer that home and remember what they did on the debt ceiling, and now they're doing it again. If he takes that approach, demagogic though it may be, I think it can work.
You see, I putting the ball in the Republicans' court, good idea. Having something to back up that forehand he didn't have. I think he showed up at a gunfight with a very dull blade. I just don't see the message, and this has been something that we have continuously talked about, the message is still not clear out of the White House. At least it wasn't in the job speech that I saw.
And it's not yet, and what I'm saying is it depends on the follow-up. I absolutely agree that that speech did not do it, in quotes, for the president.
He's really torn here, because in recent weeks he was moving his rhetoric towards an anti-Congress rhetoric reflective of something Al mentioned earlier, which is this dreadful, dreadful public approval rating of Congress writ large, down in the low teens, sort of historic lows.
Right.
And so he's got to figure out, gee, do I want to hammer the Republicans as though the Democratic Congress would do what the public wants? Oh, yeah, we just had a 60-vote majority in the Senate and a huge majority in the House, and the public basically said, throw the bums out. So he's really in a dilemma here. He'd love to take on the Republicans, but there's almost a stronger argument that he's got to just trash the Congress, not directly. He's got to be careful. He doesn't want to turn off the base and the members, but he's of two minds here, and we don't know which way he's going to end up.
I've never pulled this particular argument out in all the weeks, months we've been on the air, but
hang on to your seats, folks.
I know, my God.
Here it comes.
Here it comes. What are you going to drop on us now, Al?
Nothing terrible. I think that I am seeing it from a Democratic perspective, and you are all seeing it from a Republican perspective. Both are rational, but they are very different. And I think that I'm outnumbered here. Where's John? Where's John?
Yeah, John Freshman, the one guy I wanted here to take up your cause.
We need John. I have carefully qualified everything I've said, but I still think that it all has merit, given my qualifications. And the fact that you guys are dismissing it out of hand is where I think that Republicans will go wrong if the president continues to do what he did in that speech.
He had an opportunity to knock it out of the park. For Republican leadership to come in and say, you know what, president's got some good ideas.
I don't think he had an opportunity to knock it out of the park.
I agree with you, Al. I think any president is playing with a very, very weak hand here. Yeah. It's when you got a weak hand, it's hard
we just saw numbers come out today. Poverty levels are the highest levels they've been in decades.
What, late?
15% of America.
15% of America is living under the poverty level.
22% of kids.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that it did not knock it out of the park, but it laid the predicate, it laid the premise on which if we see a new president, if we see somebody that's going to behave differently and can follow that up with some tough rhetoric and so forth, I think he can turn it around. And you guys don't. And that's just...
No, I wouldn't say that we don't think that he might turn it around. I believe me.
The reality is with the poverty levels at the numbers that came out today, where they are, with the unemployment still hovering around 9.2, 9.3, I really hope the president can come back and deliver on this instead of it just being another weak attempt to try and get
You're missing my point. You're talking policy, I'm talking politics. And I think that he laid a premise out which it will be largely demagogic.
Okay.
It may not solve problems, but it may well appeal to people who were bent up to their Adam's apple with inactivity in the Congress. And I think he can run against the Congress.
Bob?
I think that Al may be right. I think the Republicans were wise not to dismiss it and say it's foolish.
I agree. That was a smart point.
And I think that Boehner and Kennard did exactly the right thing to, in effect, sound like we're willing to work with the president on this. We like some of the things he said. We don't like other things.
That was exactly the political thing they should have done.
Yeah, and I think...
And we've got a caller on the air. Caller, you're on the air, Backroom Politics.
Hi, this is Dick Hines, Bob's brother.
Hines, how are you doing?
Hello, Dick.
This is your international...
Let's say this: we have a lot of wetbacks and whatnot have come into the United States from Mexico, and you're one of those who have gone down there.
Wow!
And you have a lot of fun down there, I know,
Mr. Hines. You're on the air, so we're going to let you stay. And he hung up after that.
So,
wow!
So Bob won't even return his call.
Well, yeah,
and the only way he can talk to him is over his radio. And then he has to take this abuse from his brother.
That's amazing.
So, don't blame him for hanging up.
Well, we got 5 minutes left in the show. We got to get to our favorite part of the show. At least it's my favorite part of the show. It's called Tell Me a Story. We talk about any of the rumor that we're hearing around where we can scoop any of the mass media outlets and they can follow our coattails. Al, tell me a story.
Well, I told it to you earlier, you know, I do not believe that we are at a point where we can in fact make accurate decisions on where this is going. I think this is all up in the air. And the president is not dead, as some people say. He's in trouble. I think he started a way that he can work his way out. Whether he will or not, I don't know. The Republicans have clearly had to change their approach from what they were doing with the debt ceiling and how far they can go and how far they can the leadership can drag the Tea Party into that more kind and gentle opposition remains to be seen. But
wow.
We are at the very be- very beginning of this presidential election, I believe.
Wow. Bob, tell me a story.
Everybody in the country ought to be holding their breath and hoping that the super committee can come up with some solutions that will help us get through this rather serious problem we have with our debt ceiling. I think it's fair to say that there are several members of the committee who are deal makers. There are a number of members on the committee on both sides that are very firm in their political points of view and will be responsive to their leadership almost completely. But I think there's an opportunity there because the situation is so serious. I think we can have some hope. I've heard enough people say on the committee say there's a lot of good proposals out there. We can look at all of them. We don't have to start over. And let's hope that they can find some common ground.
Alan, tell me a story.
Sure. I'm gonna piggyback both these guys. With Al, it's very hard to disagree that we know what's going to happen in the next election. You don't just assume somebody's going to lose until you know who they're running against. And in America, you have to beat somebody with somebody. And you know, there was nobody weaker in a long time than George Bush in 2004, and he was ripe for the picking. And what happened? But John Kerry came up, and he was not a very good candidate, and he ran into some problems, and he got beat. Obama has got to be beaten by somebody who people think is a better president than Obama, however weak he might be. So I agree with him. On the super committee, I'm going to make a prediction. A lot's happened since we set up that committee and gave it a charge of coming up with $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in cost savings. And I think that what we're going to see now is a whole new movement to build on the 1.5 to go above that. And a group of 25 senators, bipartisan, last week said, do at least $4 trillion, which is what some of these bipartisan commissions. I'm going to predict that we are closer to $4 trillion at the end of the day than we are to the $1.2 trillion that they have to come up with, which means 2.6 or above is going to be what they're going to talk about.
Interesting. And we're going to talk about the super committee next week. Dateline, Florida, former Governor Charlie Crist is now putting together a team to look at going after the governor's seat again as a Democrat. Charlie Crist is going to run for the governorship. Rick Scott is very vulnerable. He thinks he can win as a Democrat. Charlie Crist is going to flip-flop. He's going to run as a Democrat coming up here in a couple of years.
Perhaps.
Bad move, but he can do what he wants. On behalf of Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We will be here next Tuesday, 4 to 6 Eastern Time, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob?
A place to be.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week. Have a good week, everybody. Good night.